I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Murray Slaven. Welcome, Murray.
G'day.
Here we are, sitting in the old customs house in Fremantle, looking out a window to the north, and there's the port. Beautiful sight.
Yeah, it is. It is very attractive.
One day it probably will look like that on this side, but the architects will have done a lot of work on the other side, I imagine.
I think that's the. I think that's inevitably going to happen.
But Murray, you're a very well-known Fremantle architect. Although I've read somewhere that if you hadn't been an architect, you would have been a fighter pilot.
going way back, I was very keen at school in being a pilot, and in the end made the decision to become an architect, maybe inappropriately, I'm not sure.
So you sort of had this flying ambition, but do you fly now?
I do, yeah.
I think once or twice I've received a text or an email as you fly from Bunbury or somewhere south to Jandakot, and you're complaining about what's going on down below you.
I think the last one was flying over a new development somewhere near Mandurah and looking at the 70% black roofs, including a major high school, which absolutely astonished me. And then right alongside the completely cleared area was a piece of remnant bushland, which was quite extraordinary. And I think looking at it from the air gives a fairly good picture of the issues we've got.
Well, when did you first come to Fremantle, Murray?
I was trying to remember. I think probably about early to mid 70s. And the firm we had was called Design Farm. It operated out of the old Piri Piri restaurant, which is now Kerry Hill's office. Someone was saying a while ago that we were the first architectural practice in Fremantle that century, so that shows how old we are.
So what drew you to Fremantle, and were all architects being drawn here then?
I think the good thing about Fremantle is it's probably as close as you can get to a European city where things have evolved rather than simply being transformed or changed probably. I think we're too ready to demolish and replace rather than taking the hard yards and seeing how we can make things better and or how we can adapt. And, you know, I think we've seen that in the centre of Perth with very few of the original buildings left now.
Fremantle, I suppose, in some ways was lucky not to be a little bit like Adelaide at the centre of a whole lot of 70s development.
Yeah, yeah.
But things did start to happen here. There was a big conservation movement.
Well, when we first came down here, the Fremantle Society emerged under the guidance of people like Les Lauder. I think the initiation was initiated by Main Road's intention of clearing half of High Street for a freeway down to the roundhouse, or a major highway down to the roundhouse. So that was stopped, and I think that was really the start of people starting to realise the value of what was here. Up until then, it was primarily wool stores and shipping stores in the West End, and they'd been moved into a fair bit of dereliction because of the collapse of the mining industry. You know, the gold price had collapsed, so nothing much happened.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the West End of Fremantle owes itself to a gold mining boom.
It does.
Back in the 1890s.
Definitely, yeah. And you can see links between Fremantle and Kalgoorlie. Yeah.
So in those days, I'm thinking, back in the 70s, you were an idealistic young guy, still not jaundiced and cynical about anything too much, but did they teach you anything becoming an architect, educating you as an architect, making you proficient as an architect about heritage, about a place like the West End of Fremantle?
I think it was the quality of the spaces here. Firstly, it was cheap. I had one fellow student who bought four terraces for $40,000, for instance, and they were worth, you know, basically they couldn't give them away. So a lot of people did move down. I think it was not just architects. I think a lot of young professionals started moving to the area. It became quite a vibrant place. As I said, the West End was pretty dead, but there were little practices starting to appear fairly soon after we arrived.
So what are your first, if you, in a sense, abiding memories of Fremantle as a young bloke setting up an architectural practice in Fremantle?
My first introduction to Fremantle was going to the Tarantella nightclub and walking in through the front door and seeing someone come flying down the stairwell, crashing on the floor. I think we all left after that, so we didn't go back there for a while. But it was pretty rough. But there were a lot of good people starting to come, people like some of the early people that were involved in the Fremantle Society, for instance, some of the old traders here, some of the ones that were fairly early, people like Bob Bodkin, you know, Bodkin's Bootery. A lot of the old wool buyers were still here. Some of them were pretty good. Some very old businesses, some of the businesses were some of the oldest in Australia, like Samson's and places like that. So a pretty interesting place.
It is interesting, isn't it? And Cully's tea rooms comes to mind.
Cully's,
as well.
Yeah.
Now, your practice as an architect, I imagine at times it's like anybody in the world of the visual arts, Murray. You paint something and somebody looks at it and says, "What on earth is that? My small child could have done that," or look at it and think, "Oh, that's far too figurative. Why don't they do something more abstract?" But an architect has to design and ultimately put the thing up effectively for everyone to look at, and then you get criticised or you get loved for what you've done. Is it a sort of a masochistic sort of profession you find yourself in?
Well, I think some architecture does deserve to be laughed at. I think the important thing is that it has to be put through as many filters as possible, but done in such a way that it doesn't diminish the outcome. So as a practice, we tend to measure the value of our own work. If not on a daily basis, we are fairly driven by things that are important to us, such as the Vitruvian principles, you know, of commodity, which means it's got to serve a purpose. It's got to be stable and strong, and it's got to have beauty. And on top of that, we also consider that things like commodity is to do with adaptability. So everything we build has got to be able to change use. And that's a really critical thing in our times because things are changing so quickly. Yeah.
And again, in those earlier days, although it doesn't have to be confined to them, were there architects locally or internationally who, one way or the other, inspired you or provided an example or made you think harder?
I think I was a little bit lucky because I started working. My first few years were spent with an engineering firm under Peter Bruckel, who was probably one of the best engineers Australia's produced. So my discipline came more from a fairly pragmatic basis rather than purely aesthetic, which a lot of architecture was at the time and still is. Being able to be critical of that also produces buildings that are adaptable, which is really critical, really important.
I can remember probably learning it through an Art Simon, Paul Simon Art Garfunkel song about Frank Lloyd Wright. Suddenly every architect seemed to have to aspire to what he might have done. I think one of his prairie houses is in the Museum of Modern Art or the... Yeah. It might be the Metropolitan, actually, I can't remember which, in New York. And in Australia, we had Glenn Murcutt turning corrugated iron into houses, which looked very Australian. Did something happen in Australia?
I think it did. I think the one of the most exciting things that happened in Western Australia was the movement of architects in the hills, people like Wally Greenham, Gene Mapp, and people like that, that... really started to produce their own form, very, very localised form of architecture. It didn't last, but it was still an evolutionary movement. Just wanted to clarify something about, you know, about the Glenn Murcutts of the world.
Yes.
I think the critical thing from our point of view is that the thing that we've come to notice more than anything else is that everything's teamwork. You know, there's never one person involved in a good project. We find that a lot of our, or most of our projects are very heavily influenced by the quality of a client. And we have a really good relationship with our consultants. So everything is basically teamwork. So it's never one person.
So a client sometimes will demand more of you. Is that they have their own idea of what they want, and they engage in a dialogue with you?
I think most clients certainly in our experience approach us because they have a reasonably open mind. I think that they know what they want to achieve at the end. How they get there is usually fairly negotiable. We also find that by maintaining continuous dialogue during the process, we get very good outcomes. So for instance, things like it's very hard for a client to, not all clients, but for some clients to understand that that adaptation is a really important thing, and that climate change is a critical issue to be dealt with. So leading them through the benefits of spending a little bit more on the capital we can demonstrate that it shows returns in terms of the long-term cost running of the building. Yeah.
Perhaps there's a topic I always love to explore. You can explore it in any context at all, and that's things like politics and ideology and whatever the discipline might be, architecture. But your practice, as I perceive it, covers a fairly wide range. There's residential, there's commercial, there's heritage property spoken about. There's a wide variety of other areas of your architecture. But you're very well known in central Fremantle for a job you did not so many years ago. There's a lovely steel and glass structure that's found its way in Cliff Street between an old Delgetty's building, as it was known as, on the corner of Cliff and Fillmore, and the other buildings going up Cliff Street on the western side. And it received quite a bit of reaction, this newer structure at the time it went up Murray. Has it got a nickname, this building?
Well, I've heard it called the Eyebrow, and I believe it's become a bit of a destination for wedding photographs, which is, I think, quite a nice thing. The evolution of that building, I don't think it's a new building. I don't think it's a new thing for the West End. I think that many of the architects that worked in the West End originally would have used those materials if they had have had them available. It's a very pragmatic building. The important thing is that it still fits within the form of the street. That's the critical thing. In many ways, I think that planning for the West End should be based on envelopes that aren't that fixated on the aesthetic. I think that good buildings over time, and we've seen this in history throughout Europe, good buildings over time become almost anthropomorphic. They become almost part of their community. Buildings that don't fit eventually move, and I think that's really quite important. So providing the potential for evolution is really quite critical. And I think the other thing too is that, I can't remember who it was there, one of the famous architects said that architects should be allowed to make mistakes, and I think that's a very important thing. That's part of evolution. That's how we got Gothic cathedrals, for instance.
The wonderful thing about the whole of this building, not just the Eyebrow that we've focused on, but is the rest of the building, which is now called and is headquarters here for the Mediterranean Shipping Company. Mm-hmm. Their name appears on it, and there's this magnificent Gold Rush building on that corner, and everybody who knows Fremantle knows it. And then you go around the corner, and it doesn't hit you in the eye. You have to stop and look at it, the Eyebrow. And I must say, some at the time wondered what was happening, because it wasn't a replica or a rebuild of something they imagined. It was a new building. But I like it, it fits in. But what about the rest of it, the MSC building? Did you have to do much there, or was that a refurbishment?
Yes, we did. When we started the building, we were told we'd have to cut a hole in the front of the old building and put a transformer in there. Which was a bit of a shock. Either way, whether we had to or not, we decided to make the building as energy efficient as possible. So we reduced its projected running cost by 50%, which meant we could run off the existing power in the street. We put water tanks below the car park, so all of the non-potable water supply comes from its own water capture. We use an energy air conditioning system which is called Climate Wizard, which feeds pre-cooled air back through to air conditioners, which cuts the cost dramatically. And internally, we looked at how we save costs on lighting. So we worked on, first of all LED lighting, and secondly, all stark white walls, which look really good. And they really show off things like the artwork. They've got some remarkable artwork in there. So
the result of all of this is you get an integration of something which is ostensibly new with something which is plainly old. Mm. Let's walk down in a sense High Street from the roundhouse and into the mall on High Street, not far before you get to the late 19th century town hall, early 20th century. But you've got the Cully's tea rooms and an arcade which cuts through to Cantonment Street and Market Street. And that's had that's been redeveloped in a very interesting way with a slightly greeny blue coloured glass lift going up on the top. Did you have something to do with that?
Sorry?
Did you have something to do with that?
No.
How do you respond to that sort of development in the city?
Look, I think one of the problems with architectural critique is that it's better for other people to assess it. I find it incredibly difficult to comment on a lot of architecture because I know the effort that goes into its evolution. And I think that's one of the issues that we have in terms of the way we approve buildings too, that we have peer review of projects, and it's almost impossible to have a peer review unless you've actually worked through the issue itself, the process itself.
It is interesting, isn't it? So bring it back to that proposition. So I was putting to you earlier, you build something and everyone can say whether they like it or they don't. If they don't, they can be noisy about it. If they like it, they can be full of praise. So you get different things happening. And can we expect that to keep happening, do you think, in a city like Fremantle?
Well, that particular building, when I look at it, I see details about it that I would question. But then again, I wasn't involved in the design of it, so I can't really comment whether they're right or not. I think that's a really big, really difficult thing to handle.
Yes.
I think Mies van der Rohe said God is in the detail, and which is the corollary of God is in the
devil.
Devil's in the detail.
Yes.
But when you look at a building like that, you do see things ajar. And I think one of the things about great architecture is you can walk into it and you can be in a space where there is none of that impact at all.
Then, in more recent times, Fremantle has seen a proposal on the old Spicer site for a hotel to go up. And this got everybody excited around Fremantle. People don't like high-rise, whether or not that is high-rise as such. It's right over the road from the old Waters cottages and near the recent FOMO development. And people get quite excited about it. It goes through a peer review. Fremantle Council, sort of not quite sure where they stand. It's going through went through a JDAP.
Well, that's one building I can comment on. Oh. I think it's completely inappropriate for that location. I think that the bulk and scale is completely wrong. It's a very vertical building in a horizontal city. I think that the suggestion by council that they take a level off the top and put it back further into the site would have been better. I think that I think it's a statement. And I don't agree that there should be independent statements like that in the city. I think they need to work with everything else. It's a partnership between spaces, and that doesn't really fit there.
In terms of Fremantle's future, the planning system by which large developments in Fremantle contexts like that are approved has changed over the course that you've practiced here over the last 50 years. We now have the so-called JDAP. We've got even development assessment panels above that for over $20 million developments as a result of the COVID era. Is it inevitable, do you think, that we have this centralised control applying to Fremantle, or should there be greater local control over Fremantle development?
I think there should be much earlier local control, and I think the problem with everything from design advisory committees right through the government-based process is that they're all reactive. I think the difficulty is that, and I've been on a DAC, the problem is you're confronted with a project that's already been fairly heavily worked through, and there will be problems with it, which quite often you can see as from an oversight point of view. And I think that the city should really be focusing on looking at the whole of the West End, for instance, as a model, and saying, well, with that site there, we can have that height. We can even start to look at the Balkan scale. It's almost like a virtual building on there, and let people. It's like filling, like colouring in the boxes, if you like. I think that would work a lot better, but we don't do that. One of the exercises I remember was the RNG proposal for the port, and one of the discussions we had with city about that was that if they considered it to be a huge block of cheese, what would you cut out of it to make it work? And when you take that sort of view of it, you can see how that could work as a process. But we don't do that. Everything's reactive. And the difficulty with that is that we have, in my experience, very, very good planning generally in Fremantle. I think the officers here have been pretty exceptional, and I've read quite a few of the reports. But once it goes beyond that, it then starts to turn into that quagmire of delays and opinions and reactions, which, you know, probably aren't that appropriate.
It sounds like it involves a process of negotiating an outcome rather than designing something which is optimal in the first place.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And just on a broader topic, Murray, something I think you have a passing interest in, local government and how it operates. You've been watching Fremantle all these years. You've seen the Fremantle Society blossom and bloom going back over time, and in effect took over the council in the 80s and 90s.
It did, yeah. I think it's had its highs and lows. I think the problem with any local government is when it's confronted by mass change, such as Fremantle's going through. I think that the one of the biggest challenges is the way the city will evolve now that the heart's been rebuilt, and that's we should have learned from other big cities in Europe where that's happened.
There's so many places to start, isn't there? And we'll have to continue this conversation in the future. But take Wallyalup Court, take the new administration building. You've got the FOMO there. You've got St John's Church sitting right in the middle of it. You've got this funny roadwork around it, William Street and Queen Street and Adelaide Street running north. What do you think will happen in the long run? Will we turn into a Siena and the whole of the central city be pedestrianised?
I don't think you need to do that. I think one of the problems with traffic engineering is that it's like a gate valve. It's either on or off. I tend to think more in terms of a valve, just a normal tap where you can control the volume by turning it up or down. And I think we did that. We were involved very early in the crossover between the town hall and the mall, where we put a raised pavement in there. And I remember at the time, I think we may even still have some clippings of that, was the outcry about how people were going to get run over when they, from the cars, you know, buzzing around that area. In fact, it didn't, and it worked very well. It becomes this very self-managing thing, so I don't think you need to have either traffic or no traffic. I think it can be managed.
Now, we mentioned we're right here at the port, and we're looking across at it. You mentioned the ING development earlier. We know there's a big future of Fremantle project going on, chaired by Nicole Lockwood, a lot of community and government departmental participation in that. If we could transport ourselves back here, Murray, in 30 years' time, which may not be possible for either of us.
I wouldn't give up yet.
No, give up yet. What do you think will be happening on each side of the port?
Well, I'm hoping that there will be some pragmatic common sense start to emerge, which, and one of the based on things like we have the most highly urbanised population in the world, we have the most highly coastal based population in the world, We have huge distances, and the cheapest way to move material is across the ocean. So having this unique opportunity that we've inherited of a port in the middle of an urban area seems to me too precious to be able to be turning into hotels. I think we need to be very careful how we manage that. I think shipping will change. I think we're already seeing that. We're supplying small transport cargo and ferries to use the North Sea, for instance. I mean, I don't see it will be very far before we start doing that here. Road transit is going to get too expensive.
Are you imagining there will still be a working port despite the government's plans to move most of the working port to Cronulla?
I think it will, because I think for bringing in huge components is fine to a port like that, but when you've got inter-regional transport, I think that's where these central ones will still be important.
And what do you think will happen between Leighton, where we've got residential apartment development, seemingly at appropriate setbacks, taking into account all the other things you were mentioning, climate change and rising sea levels and all of that, and coming south to the port? What will the future look like there?
I think it will be fairly high density residential. I don't really have a problem with that. I think that the other thing we need to think about is if it's not too late now, is the metropolitan area almost as an island, where we have to simply put a boundary around and say we can't expand any further. And once we do that, then population's got to work out how it's going to fit itself back into the space we've got. So I think those areas such as that, which do have the potential for that.
That's a very interesting concept, the metropolitan area as an island, and just harking back to you taking photographs over what's below you as you flew from, say, Bunbury to Jandakot, there's an argument, isn't there, if not the reality, that the Perth metropolitan area extends from Bunbury all the way to Launceston in the north.
Yeah.
Can we put a ring fence around it?
I think with will we can, yeah.
Now, let's just think about Fremantle as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You've been here right through a long period. You've seen things come and go. You've seen movements come and go. People are constantly asking what the future, if you like, economically and every other respect, is for Fremantle. Do you have a vision? People are always complaining about an empty shop front on High Street or a building that's too tall in the centre of Fremantle or a development they don't like wherever. How do you see Fremantle developing? Has it been organic to this point? Are we likely to see, if it is, more organic development in the future?
I think it has been fairly organic. I think it needs to be managed. I don't think it needs to be controlled so much as managed. I think that... And that goes back to that point about being proactive in terms of planning. And I'm not saying they don't do that. I'm just saying we need to be more proactive in a much greater detail than we do now. I think that the future of Fremantle, the potential is to open the city up to technology, for instance. So we lost one opportunity. We were involved in a project on the Point Street site for a company called Zernica, which was a venture capitalist out of Holland, at the time was running Tech Park, and they said Tech Park should all be in the middle of the city. And they put a proposal together for a development on that site, which didn't happen. But I think that's what needs to happen. There are sites that could do that, lots of sites around the West End. I think that you don't need a lot of space for it. I think that there are upper floors that could be used for combinations of, research or residential. They're all very flexible, which come back to that whole point about being adaptable. So having buildings that are, that can be new or old, but are designed to be able to have a change of use very quickly, I think is really important.
I always wondered what happens in the second, or if there are third, levels in old buildings around the planet, actually, but particularly here in Fremantle. Do we have a lot of disused space?
There's quite a bit, yeah. Yeah.
And what's it calling out for? Well, you can turn it into tech space. Does it require a lot of adaptation for that sort of
thing? No, not a lot. I think the big demand right now is residential. I think getting people up into those spaces. We're doing a lot of work with St. Pat's, for instance, on housing, and the demand is huge. The more you read about it, it's just we're not going to be able to catch up. And I'm not convinced that government spending huge amounts of money building new houses out in new tracts of cleared land is really the solution. I think a lot of the people that need that housing need to be in a city.
Now, Murray, I mentioned much earlier on that I'd come back and ask questions about politics, ideology, you can add philosophy if we like, and any discipline, in your case, architecture. Do philosophies, ideologies, politics enter into what architects do? You've also mentioned St. Pat's. They provide homelessness services all around Fremantle. Do these things sort of mesh together?
Yes, they do, very definitely.
How?
I think that, well, I think you can either take, you can take a position as an architect, either you treat it as a business or you treat it as a life, as a way of living, which is a little bit more, perhaps, I don't want to say ethical, I think it's all ethical, but I think that the, you need to make a decision at some point. So, for instance, we do quite a bit of pro bono work when we think it's important. I think that's one thing architects can do. Architects are innovators, and I think that they can often find solutions that government can't.
And just in your own case, you came to Fremantle. Where did you grow up?
In the country, Narrogin. Well, Narrogin. First of all, Northampton, then Narrogin.
Yeah. Northampton, then Narrogin. Mm. There used to be lots of country lads and girls around the place, but... was Narrogin a place where you grew up developing a world outlook? Did you?
Oh, Narrogin was a really interesting place because my first 5 years were in Northampton, and I hardly knew any children other than Indigenous. Moving to Narrogin was a shock, starting school there. But the Narrogin at the time I went to school was a displaced persons camp. It had something like 5,000 people living there that were all living in a tent city. So most of the people I went to school with were from all over the world.
Amazing concept. Just pause on that for a moment. This is Australia, which people talk of as a backwater, which the rest of the world didn't seem to discover until the Sydney Olympics in 2000. Yeah. But this is around about the 1950s, is it?
Yeah.
And there's this displaced persons camp with people from all around the world. Where did they come from? Why were they there?
All over. Well, my parents were migrants. I mean, my father's a doctor, but we're still migrants. They came from literally all over the world. And they were put into Narrogin because it was the centre of 5 rail lines. So they primarily work on railways. But it's an interesting comment on our refugee situation now, where... I look at the people I went to school with and look at the contribution they've made to the world or to Australia. It's pretty remarkable. So I think we didn't learn much from that. Perhaps we should have.
Growing up in a place like Narrogin with all of this happening around you, did you sort of develop some sensitivities about the country, about its makeup, about your own politics? Outlook,
yeah, definitely. Yeah, very definitely. I mean, I think my parents, it's fair to say, were very left wing, very heavily involved in representing the migrant population as well as just being a doctor. Also, same with Indigenous. We regularly we'd come home from school and there'd be several Indigenous people sitting around for lunch at home, which was great. It didn't. I think it bothered my people that my mother knew a lot, but I think that was a really important thing to learn from.
So, were your mother and father sort of equal drivers in all of that community engagement, or was it
no,
more
I think,
your father?
No, they were just very quiet people who did whatever they needed to do, basically.
Yes. Mm. And where had they found their way from?
Well, Mum came from Moscow.
Wow.
Dad came from Ukraine via Vladivostok, via China, via Japan, via China back to Australia. So they arrived. He arrived when he was about 13, I think, and went to Melbourne, not grammar school, Melbourne University College, I think it was called at the time, and won a scholarship and studied medicine. So.
Amazing story, Murray. And in a sense, all of this has been repeated around us today.
Yeah.
You mentioned Ukraine.
Yeah.
Amongst other places.
Yes.
Yeah. So, in your own practice, I mentioned earlier, you cover a range of things. And in fact, do I get the sense that you sometimes have done architectural things in relation to cemeteries?
Yes, somehow or other we've become very involved in with the cemetery board, which has been quite an interesting experience. They're great to work with. It's really good, interesting working with a client who takes an incredibly long view of things, which they have to. It's allowed us to produce buildings that are, again, pick up on that fourth dimension of time. So we can build buildings for them, or we can work on buildings for them that we deliberately put a 100-year life cycle on. So, for instance, we finished a chapel recently that that requires no external power for heating, cooling or lighting. We've demonstrated the payback is only 11 years, which makes you wonder why we aren't doing that more often. I think that's been a very, very important thing. Yeah, it's been really interesting. It's been good working with them. Yeah.
That presumably brings, speaking broadly, a spiritual element to what you're doing.
Definitely, yeah.
What effect, if that's the right word, are you wanting to have on people who come to some service or event at a cemetery in that place you've designed?
I think it's primarily a combination of things like permanence and peace. We've learned an awful lot working with people like the Franciscan Order, for instance, reflecting on a lot of the their spiritual beliefs, their religious beliefs, and St. Francis himself. So. I'm not particularly religious myself, but I can see the value in that, and I think it allows us to take a fairly objective approach to it. So when we do things like work at Karakata, we ensure that there are places that are relaxing where people can sit and contemplate. I think it's a very important thing, because generally they're fairly harsh places.
I've often thought, not being a religious person myself, but having been brought up a Catholic, but there are these wonderful spaces called churches, usually, and you find plenty of them around Fremantle. The Wesley Church here, the magnificently timbered building inside. St. John's I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
St. Patrick's, you mentioned the community service provided by St. Pat's, but the church, you've got the Scots Church. They keep producing.
Mm.
And I've often wondered whether they shouldn't be fully opened up, turned into places where art can be displayed, quite apart from whatever religious icons are there, and because of these qualities that they often have.
I think that will happen. I think we're seeing. Well, we're also currently working on the restoration of the Redemptorist Monastery in North Perth, and we've just finished re-roofing the whole monastery and church, and we're just now starting to look at restoring the church itself. It comes back to that point about anthropometric buildings. You know, they become a persona, they take on their own persona. So, for instance, with the Redemptorists, it's absolutely superb for music performances. For instance, it's almost like being inside a big cello or a big bass. It's extraordinary sound.
So we Hans Hook takes his Fremantle Chamber Orchestra there occasionally.
Yeah, yes,
as well as, of course, the Fremantle Town Hall.
Yeah, so. and I think religion probably is changing a bit too. I think that I remember Ted Noffs, I think, from the Sydney
the Wayside Chapel.
Wayside Chapel was saying that people are moving away from church, but it doesn't mean they're becoming less spiritual. And I thought that was an interesting comment, that people are starting to look for their own spirituality rather than being told what their spirituality should be. And I think that's where churches can adapt and become very important.
Well, one space we lost, I'm not sure if it has been turned into to a spiritual place, perhaps it has, is the old synagogue, Murray.
Yeah.
Pity that was lost in a way.
I feel quite uncomfortable about that. I think that There was a proposal, when it came up for sale, there was a proposal to turn it into a World Peace Centre, which I thought was quite an interesting concept.
What a lovely idea.
It was put to council and dismissed, which I feel a bit sorry about. I can understand that there has to be a use found for it, but I think that when we have buildings that have got such a strong historical background, you know, that people have spent a lot of emotional involvement in that building, I think probably we need to find better uses for it. And I don't just mean churches or synagogues, I mean places, you know, like parks and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Jewish connection, particularly at the turn of the century, coming right on in Fremantle, was quite significant.
Yeah.
It's just a pity it's lost. You at least can still see that it's the old synagogue and it carries the name.
Yeah, I agree.
Which probably encourages a whole lot of conversation and eye-opening. Parks and gardens around Fremantle. Is it a pet love, a pet hate? Have we got enough? Are we doing enough with them? I'm thinking particularly of the Queen's Garden area on the four sides of the intersection at Parry and High Street.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's broken up into four parts is a bit sad. I think that it would have been really nice to find some way of making better use of that. There was a proposal years ago to change the way the roads worked there, but it had, but in the end it remained an intersection. So,
I've been exercising my mind. I'll have to ask you to keep exercising yours over it, because it is to me a completely lost space. It's some use, but it's empty.
Well, the one that appealed to me was to turn it into a large roundabout and actually put an island in the middle of it and turn it into a jungle in the middle of that, which would have been fabulous. It didn't happen for whatever reason.
I'm not sure I'm going to vote for that one. We get towards the end of this conversation. If you were the emperor for even a short period, is there something that you would just love to do in Fremantle? Not put a big roundabout at the intersection of Parry and High Streets, but perhaps something else?
I think I'd really like to have a process whereby we looked at the future of the West End in particular being the core of what we are. And again, having the ability to be proactive and to develop scenarios, to explore scenarios or hypotheticals, if you like. We don't tend to do that. Again, we tend to be very active, but I think that the hypothetical things are a really important thing to start looking at for Fremantle.
It's been lovely talking to you. We'll keep chatting from time to time about what's happening in Fremantle, but thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.